from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. How about a quick round of word association? The category is environment. The clue is delta. Here we go. I say peripheral, and you say canal. Right. Words that conjure up the old environmental debate over how to fix the aging water system that diverts water from the delta to central and southern California. Back in 1982, then-Governor Jerry Brown championed a peripheral canal to solve the problem. 30 years later, he's back with a new plan and a new word. So now, if I say peripheral, you say tunnel. A new plan and an old debate. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning for Michael Krasny. Fixing the Delta's aging waterworks has proved to be a daunting task. The current system of aging levees and pumps provides water to the Central Valley and Southern California, but its impact on the Delta's ecosystem and its earthquake vulnerability has spurred a decades-long debate over how to replace it. It's a problem the once and future Governor Brown knows well. 30 years ago, he championed building a peripheral canal around the Delta. Yesterday, the governor was back with a new plan, a pair of 35-mile tunnels that would move water under the Delta.
Yes, there's going to be some opposition. It goes with the territory. But just let me say that a healthy Delta ecosystem and a reliable water supply are profoundly important to California's future.
Governor Jerry Brown speaking yesterday. So in this hour of Forum, the new plan to fix the Delta. Joining us first to get us started on the basics of the plan, Paul Rogers, environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and managing editor of Quest, KQED's science and environmental series. Paul, good morning. Paul, are you with us?
I am, indeed.
Happy to have you join us. Tell us first what the basics of the plan are, this pair of 35-mile-long tunnels, and the why behind it. Why is the thought that this would solve this age-old debate?
Yeah, this is a major milestone in Jerry Brown's governorship, not unlike the high-speed rail project that he has proposed. He's essentially trying to solve a decades-old problem in California. You know, the problem basically in California with water is that three-quarters of the water is in the north, and three-quarters of the people and the demand are in the south. And so for the last century or so, we have tried to figure out ways to move water from north to south. And the Delta, which is this vast series of sloughs and marshes and rivers between the Contra Costa area and sort of Stockton and south of Sacramento, is the linchpin of California's water supply. It's where 25 million Californians get some or all of their drinking water from. It irrigates about 3 million acres of land in the Central Valley that provides nearly half of America's produce. And, going back to essentially the 1930s, we have drawn an increasing amount of water from the Delta and pumped it south in the various canals that you see when you're driving up and down I-5 and other parts of the state. And the problem is that over time, drawing all that water, along with some other factors, has basically crashed the ecosystem of the Delta. It's made rivers run backwards. It's ground up and crushed migrating fish like salmon and smelt and other fish. And it's changed the chemistry of the water, the mix between fresh and saline. And so what Brown is attempting to do is find out a way that the water users, some of the big cities, including San Jose, Los Angeles, San Diego, and the big farm districts, can have a more reliable source of water and at the same time improve the health of the Delta. And he believes that by building this tunnel around sort of the periphery, that's why it's called peripheral, the periphery, the east side of the Delta, you can reduce the reliance on the giant pumps that are in the south part of the Delta at Tracy. So you wouldn't have as many problems grinding up endangered fish, and you wouldn't have court challenges as much that in recent years have stopped some of the pumping and slowed it down. That's the plan. But as he mentioned, it's quite controversial.
And Paul, set us up then for the debate that we're now going to explore for the rest of our hour this morning. In brief, what are the pro side arguing for, and what are the contrary points of view?
The supporters of the plan argue that the Delta is far too unreliable of a major water source for a state like California. They argue that unless something is done, you're going to have continuing problems, not only with earthquakes that could potentially wreck some of the 1,000 miles of aging earthen levees that keep salt water from the bay, out of the freshwater area where the pumps go. They argue that needs to be fixed, and they also argue that we just need to reduce reliance on those big pumps so that we can keep the water flowing more regularly without disruption, so that cities and farmers can plan on it. Opponents argue that by building this, what you'll actually be doing is taking the biggest source of fresh water, which is the Sacramento River, taking water from that river just south of Sacramento, not allowing it as much of it to flow into the Delta, which is this great mixing zone of ocean water from the bay and fresh water from melting Sierra snows. You won't have that fresh water going into the Delta directly, not as much, and so the water quality of the Delta will decline, they argue. That will certainly harm farmers in the Delta area who rely on it. They argue that it will further harm fisheries. And most important, their main concern is one of trust, that if you build pipes this big, these are essentially, each pipe is as wide as 3 lanes of freeway, that no matter what promises are made about when the water would be taken and how much would be taken, eventually the powerful interests, big farm districts, Southern California water agencies, will always want to take more. And in the end, they argue, the environment will lose. This is going to play out over the next couple of years, and it could very well end up on the ballot again, just like it did in 1982.
Paul Rogers, environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, managing editor of Quest here at KQED. Let's introduce the rest of our panel this morning so we can get into the issues that Paul just outlined for us. Carla Nemeth is the program manager for the Bay Delta Conservation Plan as part of the California Natural Resources Agency. Carla Nemeth, good morning. We'll hope to get Carla in just a moment. Joining us as well is Barbara Berrigan-Paria. She's the executive director of Restore the Delta, which is a coalition that has real concerns about the plan that Governor Brown announced yesterday. Barbara Berrigan-Paria, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And Jason Peltier joins us as well. He's the chief deputy general manager of the Westlands Water District, a member of the California Farm Water Coalition. Westlands is the largest water irrigation district in the nation. Jason Peltier, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
Barbara Berrigan-Paria, why don't you take it a beat further than what Paul Rogers was describing in terms of concerns about this? Paul's last point was this question of trust, that even though the governor is saying that there will be trust in how this will move forward, that there will be a concern about how much water should be pumped and the way in which that would affect the environment, this feeling that no matter what promises are made, the demand will be such that the environment will always get a short shrift. Give us your sense of that particular concern.
Well, we believe that that is true. When you pencil out the costs for the project, you're looking at $17 to $20 billion in construction costs. And with financing, you're looking at a payback of around $51 billion. An independent cost-benefit and economic analysis was done by Dr. Jeff Michael at the University of the Pacific. And, you know, according to his estimates, water will cost from this project for farmers about $1,000 per acre foot. This project, in this version of the BDCP, they're actually looking at scaling back the amount of water taken from the Delta, at least on paper, they claim. But if you pencil it out, the water agencies can't afford to pay for this project and take less water.
So your belief is that the only way this can really move forward, the only way it's financially viable, is to increase the amount of water, increase the demand?
Oh, yes. In fact, representatives from the Westlands Water District and Metropolitan Water District said earlier this year in a Senate hearing at the Capitol that, you know, they're looking at going back up to 2005 levels for water taken out of the Delta. That's what they are expecting, and that's what their boards would expect so that they would be able to finance the project.
Well, we'll hear from Westlands and Jason Peltier in a moment, but Carla Nemeth, if you're back with us, respond to that particular concern that the demand is always going to trump the environment.
So, good morning. I believe I must have missed the earlier introduction, but tracking with the conversation and Ms. Berrigan-Puria's response, I think, you know, we acknowledge those concerns, and I think moving forward, it's important for folks to realize that our current capacity of facilities is 15,000 CFS, and our current capacity to export water is at 15,000 CFS, and that even with that larger capacity, we're now contemplating a facility that is substantially smaller than that. But the major point being that our environmental laws do work, and that we have been operating to achieve those environmental benefits over time, and what we're proposing today is a system that would actually make compliance with those environmental laws much more effective. It relies on a strong governance structure, which I believe the Brown administration, together with the Obama administration, has proposed, as well as a strong science foundation and adaptive management program, which is also part of the proposal.
So if I understand your point correctly, you're saying that no matter what the demand may be, that there are laws in place that will make sure that the environment isn't something that suffers because of that increased demand?
That's correct. And another point that I think is really important for folks to understand is that in this regulatory construct, which is a natural communities conservation plan, we are seeking to achieve actual recovery of species, that we're setting these species on a course to recovery. It is the strictest environmental standard in the country, and that's not something that we're managing to at all with the current status quo. We've got a plan with over 200 biological goals and objectives, and it's to those biological goals and objectives we will be managing a science process and an adaptive management process. So we are very confident that we are crafting a plan that is going to put species on a course to recovery. That's our goal. It's a critical part of the entire package that the administrations are putting forward.
Carla Nemeth, the program manager for the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Jason Peltier is with us as well, Chief Deputy General Manager for Westlands Water District, which is part of the California Farm Water Coalition. Jason Peltier, I want to hear from you about why you support the plan and its importance to farmers. But before we get to that, respond to this question of demand and trust and whether or not you're going to be asking for water, whether the water's there or not, whether the environment would be harmed or not.
Well, if I could, I think it's a more important little setup here for me to go back to Paul's intro for a second. Because it was a great introduction with one exception, and that exception is his explanation of the damage caused by the export pumps. That is the historic view. He reflected the historic view of the export pumps and of many people, including the Endangered Species Act regulators.
These are the big pumps that have been viewed as the problem in terms of grinding up fish and creating a real shortage for those particular species.
Right. Well, we dispute that they have a population-level effect. We acknowledge fish are taken, they're captured, they're relocated to other places in the Delta from the pumps. But what's important to note about yesterday's announcement, about 6 years of work and $140 million invested in our planning process so far to address the deteriorating conditions in the Delta, is that historic view and that the regulators have taken obviously hasn't worked. Just reducing the pump operations has not been reflected, and we've not seen it reflect in better fish populations. What's exciting about the path we're on today is it's a new and different approach. It's a comprehensive approach, not a species-by-species approach, but let's look at all the factors, all the issues, all the stressors that are affecting the fish, from toxics to invasive species, where we have 95% of the aquatic biota in the Delta is invasive. Let's look at overfishing. Let's look at lack of habitat. So that is, it's important to keep that in mind as we have this conversation. On the trust issue, Carla is correct. I mean, we do have, and Barbara's correct. We would like to get back to historic levels of reliability. There's no doubt about it, because there's a lot of economic dislocation that's occurred with these, what I see as needless reductions in exports. But we have capacity between the federal and state water project pumps down near Tracy to take twice the amount of water we've ever taken before out of the Delta. And we have layers and layers of laws and regulations. We've got State Water Board limits. We've got Endangered Species Act limits. We've got Clean Water Act limits. We've got Corps of Engineer limits. We've got, so we are, it's a pretty tightly regulated facility, and that's the reality, and that's the reality that's going to be with us going forward.
Jason Peltier at the Westland Waters District. I'll come back to you in just a moment, Jason, to fill in more about the importance of it for farm. But let me do a quick bit of fact checking here, since you've raised a couple of points, and ask you to do that if you would, Paul Rogers, both in terms of whether or not the problem with the fish is about water level. Jason is challenging that particular question. And also on this question about whether or not laws are sufficiently in place that regardless of demand, that the environment will be protected.
Well, both of these things are right at the crux of the debate. It's very interesting. There are a lot of folks who have different opinions about why the species in the Delta have been crashing. And a lot of scientists have offered up in different studies various reasons. Invasive species is one reason, like Jason mentioned. Ammonia coming into the Delta from the Sacramento wastewater treatment plant is another one. But you would be hard-pressed to find scientists at any of the federal or state agencies who regulate endangered species who say that the annual removal of roughly 50% of all the fresh water that flows into the Delta has not been harming the fish who live in the Delta. That's to say that is simply not supported by the science. And I don't think Jason is going that far. I think it's a question of degree. So we'll leave that up to the scientists to argue, but there have been a lot of independent reports that do show that when you make rivers run backwards and you take 50% of the water out of the system, that does affect the salmon and the steelhead and other species that swim through there. As to the question about regulations, you know, again, a lot of the details that we've seen in the news in the last 5 years or so really have people arguing crossways on the facts. Unfortunately, it's become like so many other major public policy issues in America. I mean, for the last couple of years, there were signs up and down the Central Valley about how the Delta smelt was responsible for, this is an endangered fish, that there was a court ruling related to that fish, reducing some of the pumping. There were signs up and down about how the smelt had cost the farmers a great deal of water. That was partially true. The State Department of Water Resources showed that 25% of the water reductions in recent years, until our most recent drought ended, were from those court-ordered pumping reductions, but 75% was from the drought that we had from 2007 to 2009. So there's a lot of shades of gray here, and it's very complicated for the average member of the public because there's a lot of complex jargon, there's a lot of history, there's a lot of law, but really, you know, what it comes down to is that California is largely an arid state. Most of this state gets about 15 inches of rain a year. That includes Los Angeles, that includes San Jose, that includes large parts of the San Joaquin Valley. In fact, they get even a little less. The 15 inches of rain a year is the same amount as Casablanca, Morocco. And California has 38 million people. We have more people than Canada, and we have the largest agricultural industry in the United States. And so there's an enormous demand on water in an area that if we didn't have these massive water systems, we would be growing cow chips instead of silicon chips. There wouldn't be a Hollywood, there wouldn't be a Silicon Valley, there wouldn't be a Central Valley ag industry. So billions of dollars depend on these questions.
So given that water means everything in California and always has, let's take this a little further in terms then of what's at stake. Barbara Berrigan-Perea, first you, and then Jason Peltier, on what's at stake from each of your perspectives. Barbara?
Well, first off, there's a $5 billion a year agriculture economy that is tied to the Delta. People forget about that. In fact, the Delta is the largest region of prime farmland in the state of California. It doesn't have the drainage impairment problems that you find in the Westlands Water District. In addition to this $5 billion agricultural economy tied to the Delta, we have 4 million people living behind levees in the Delta that need protection. We have a recreational fishing industry and recreation industry within the Delta that's worth about $700 million a year. And then, of course, the Delta is the estuary that is tied to the bay and to the ocean that produces a commercial salmon fishing industry, you know, for California and for Southern Oregon, that's estimated to be close to worth $1 billion a year.
And your view is that the tunnel plan would, setting aside for a moment the question of the environment and the fish that we've been debating, you're also saying that that would have a disastrous impact on farmers within the Delta itself?
Oh, it would destroy our sustainable Delta family farms. You know, agriculture in the Delta is human-scale agriculture. These are some of California's oldest family farms. They've been farming for 6 generations. They were the people who originally supplied food to San Francisco when it was the largest city in the state. You know, our economy is tied to that, and it would just absolutely wreak economic havoc on this region.
And Jason Peltier, just have a minute or so before we go to our break, but give us your take then on what's at stake from your point of view.
I totally disagree with Barbara's construct that there's a choice between preserving, protecting, saving the Delta and getting enough water moved south to sustain the economy. $400 billion worth of the state's economy is tied directly or indirectly to the water that moves south. That is a huge economic stake and a lot of people's lives at risk, and it's not a trade-off between farms and cities to the south and the Delta. There's no question about that.
And Carla Nemeth, before we go to break, your view would be that this is a plan that can bridge the differences between what the interests that Barbara Berrigan-Perea represents and Jason Peltier?
Yeah, I do believe that is the case. And I think while Barbara's concerns are very valid, I tend to agree with Jason that the construct of an either-or is not a construct that's going to get us to move forward, and we need to have better conversations with folks in the Delta and put together better information on how we understand the impacts to Delta communities of the proposal that's being put forward and how we address those in very serious ways.
Carla Nemeth, the program manager for the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear more from all of our guests about what's at stake in this debate and about there's no way to overestimate the importance of it and the importance of water to the state of California. So we'd like to hear from you as well. How do you want to see this debate go forward? What are your concerns about the plan that the governor put forward yesterday? What do you like about its potential? You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can add your comments on our website or on our Facebook page as well. Back with more about the future of the Delta and the future of water in California when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, a new plan to solve the decades-old debate over fixing the water system that runs through the Delta that diverts water to farms and cities around the state. It's a debate that goes back to the 1980s and the days of the peripheral canal. Now Governor Brown is back with a new plan, a peripheral tunnel that would move water in a different way. Lots of calls and emails and comments on our website coming in. Let's get right to them. Paul Rogers, take this one first, if you would, please. Paul from San Jose writes in, "Yesterday I looked all over for a map showing where the tunnels would be located. I couldn't find one. Can some of your guests tell us where the tunnels would actually be?"
A number of the newspaper stories that have written about this, as well as KQED's site, I believe, have posted maps. Essentially, think of a spot just south of Sacramento. There's a little community called Freeport there, and about 10 miles south of Sacramento. And there would be three large intakes right there on the Sacramento River, and those would flow pretty much south, a little bit sort of south-southwest for 37 miles to Tracy, where they would then connect up with the two big pumping systems for the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Jillian, who writes, I don't understand how pulling water from a different part of the delta will be any better for the ecosystem. Isn't the fundamental problem that we just take too much water from the system? So Carla Nemeth, take that one on. This gets to the question of volume, but also does just like in real estate, does location matter here in terms of where the tunnel actually takes place?
Oh, it absolutely matters. In fact, the Department of Fish and Game since the 1960s has had the opinion offered by its fishery biologists that the location, the current location of the State and Federal Water Project pumps in the southern part of the delta are an impairment to fish species. And if we want to fix that problem, we need to find a different location. A couple of things about what we're focused on as we put this plan together and as we think about moving the primary point of diversion is an opportunity to fundamentally fix this reverse flow problem that we have in the heart of the delta, and the fact that the way that we transmit water through the delta currently pulls fish species into the pumps. It pulls actually food sources into the pumps, and we're at a situation where anywhere between 60% and 90% of salmonid species, for example, don't make it moving through the delta, and that's a problem that we have to fix. Fundamentally, the relocation of the pumps with a state-of-the-art fish screens, we believe, will create a situation where we can help those species survive as they're moving through the system. It's something that, as I mentioned, our Department of Fish and Game has been on the record about since the 1960s. So it's a problem that in many ways we know a lot about the plumbing infrastructure and its challenges for fish species, and that's something we have to correct.
And let me get in one more email question, and then we'll get right to our calls. Anne writes in, you're not mentioning the negative impacts on drinking water in the delta that the city of Antioch and Contra Costa Water District rely upon. The impact is due to increased salinity, which will impact drinking water and the fisheries as well. Is that also one of your concerns, Barbara Berrigan-Perea?
Yes, it is. And in addition to that concern for Contra Costa region, the city of Stockton has just finished construction of a new water intake plant that would be negatively infected. All the cities around the delta would have problems with discharge because the water would become so salty and pollutant times would increase without freshwater flows. They would be in violation of Clean Water Act's standards whenever they had to discharge.
And Paul Rogers, can you help us understand sort of how this will play out in the political process? We've seen a lot of people in the Delta areas. Barbara Berrigan-Perea was just describing, voiced their opposition. Congressman Garamendi, also representing part of that area, voiced his opposition. Where does this get played out? Is this something the legislature has to weigh in on? You mentioned the possibility of yet another voter referenda on this. Where will how will this move forward?
Well, the short version is that they will come out with a draft environmental impact statement this fall. They will attempt to get what's called a record of decision, a final decision by next spring or next summer. And then the idea would be they need to get permits from the state and federal agencies to allow a 50-year plan where some salmon and smelt and other endangered species could be killed in exchange for doing 100,000 acres of habitat restoration, wetlands, which could cost $4 or $5 billion. and other types of environmental upgrades. The politics of it are fascinating, though. Contra Costa County, the Board of Supervisors voted 2 weeks ago 5-0 to oppose this. That's not a surprise because of their concerns about water quality, as you just mentioned. But it's actually splitting some coalitions as well. Democrats are split. Certainly Democrats in Southern California and the Central Valley are big fans of this. The Obama administration obviously supports it. The Brown administration supports it.
Environmental groups are split as well.
They are indeed. The House members, 12 Northern California House members, all Democrats, led by John Garamendi and George Miller and people like Jackie Speer and Mike Thompson, they all issued pretty strong statements yesterday against it. I mean, Jackie Speer, looking at her remarks, she said, "A plan this reckless will not succeed." Mike Thompson said, "It's choosing politics over science. It's a bad deal for Northern California." But, you know, they are at odds with Senator Boxer and Senator Feinstein, who support it. The environmental groups are also split. The Sierra Club, Planning and Conservation League, Barbara's Group, a number of others, many others actually, along with most of the major coastal fishing groups in the state, are strongly opposed. They think the main way to solve this problem is to pump less fresh water and to find other ways to get water, water recycling, water conservation. But other groups like the Nature Conservancy, perhaps Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund, they've sort of issued a statement saying maybe. If there are certain conditions and guarantees and the water users pay more, then maybe they'll go for it. Because they are also concerned about the impact of these giant pumps on fish.
Yeah.
And frankly, they like the idea of 100,000 acres of wetlands restored because there's not very much money in other pots for that kind of work.
And let's go to our calls. Mike starts us out in Palo Alto. Mike, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm a fisherman and a California taxpayer. And I think Barbara's making some really good points. I wanted to expand on those a little bit. I think we're going to have a lot of unintended consequences for rushing into this plan. I know we're talking about fixing the reverse flow in the San Joaquin, which is a great goal. But at the same time, we're trading that to take as much as 100% of the flow from the Sacramento River. And I think we do know, actually, what the impact would be. It would be disastrous. And the exporters want us to ignore that fact. The fact that this is a conservation plan is a misnomer at best and criminal at least.
Mike, you think this is all about just getting water to the cities and to big ag interests?
Absolutely. This is nothing more than a water grab. It's a power shift from the northern part of the state to the southern part of the state. And then we have the Westlands in the middle that will act as broker.
Yeah. Okay, Mike, thanks.
Control this resource.
Let's get Jason Peltier's response.
Well, it would be nice to have the conversation in terms of dealing with the facts and reality rather than the bumper stickers and the rhetoric, because the facts are very straightforward. It's there are contracts, there are limits, there are realities in terms of how much water can be moved. This notion that we're going to destroy water quality is to say that the project would destroy water quality is to say the Clean Water Act is no longer in effect. Well, I'm sorry, it is. And there will be standards, there will be flow standards. We will not take 100% of the Sacramento River move south by any means at all, whatsoever. It's a graduated diversion rate based on inflow with huge bypass flows required by the fishery agencies and the State Water Board. Those bypass flows will assure that water quality standards in the Delta, existing standards, are met on into the future. And if there's some small diminution, we'll have to deal with that. But the notion that this opens the tap wide open to move water south is ridiculous. It defies reality.
And to Ralph in San Jose. Ralph, go ahead. You're next.
A couple points. First off, there is a book, and there was a three-part miniseries called Cadillac Desert that talked about the California Water Project, its history, creation, and the politics of water in California. It may be somewhat dated now, but somehow, amazingly, KQED and KTEH lost the paperwork that allowed them to broadcast it, and they were the rights holders for it. The second point is that they're talking mostly about supply sides of things, whereas nobody seems to want to address the probably harder issue of our extremely wasteful and inefficient use of water in California. The agriculture in the Central Valley is by far the largest consumer of water in California. And those signs are still down on I-5, except now they say Congress created Dust Bowl or Nancy Pelosi created Dust Bowl. Ironically, a lot of that's right in front of flood irrigated fields and stuff like that that are lush and green, which is insane.
Okay, Ralph, thanks for taking us to that topic. Craig writes about that in Redwood City as well, and Jason Peltier, your response after this, please. Craig writes, the federal government realized a decade ago that the only solution to California's water problems is to buy out entire irrigation districts that use the water. You've heard that concern, I know, before. You heard what our last caller just had to say, that really this is about farming and farming in a way that's not sustainable.
Right. I just got to say, I've never, ever in my life seen flood irrigation in Westlands Water District. I'm sure it's occurred in the past. It sure doesn't occur this year or in the present. Over the last 20 years, we've had shortages of 40, 60, 90% of our allocation from the Central Valley Project. As a result, the district has taken 100,000 acres of land out of production, partly to deal with the drainage issue and partly to consolidate the water supply. Our farmers have invested in millions and millions and millions of dollars into drip and micro sprinklers. Over 80% of the land in the district is on drip, is on micro sprinklers, and so you know we're damn proud of our productivity. We get some of the without question biggest yields of tomatoes, almonds, and we're growing more vegetables. We're growing a lot less cotton than we did historically, but that's market driven. But the food part of this equation is important, and this is a place probably where Barbara and I can come together, which is to recognize that we're the number one state in the nation. We're the in terms of ag production, we're also the most heavily urbanized state in the nation, and we have not ever reconciled those two realities. And the appreciation for what we do to keep food prices down, keep vegetables on plates, is fleeting at best by the public.
Well, let's sorry. Go ahead. Is that Barbara? Go ahead.
Yes, it is. I would like to say this isn't a place where Jason and I can come together. Westlands contributes less than 0.3% to California's economy, yet 70% of the water that is taken from the Delta goes to West Side, San Joaquin Valley agriculture, and down into Kern County. There was conversation earlier about this construct that we believe it's an either-or situation, water for the Delta or water for farms in the Central Valley and further south into the cities. No, that's not what we believe. What we believe is that we have enough water to share with Southern California. State Water Resources Control Board hearings at the end of 2010 determined that we can divert about 25% of this estuary safely. And that water should go to Southern California, which, of course, is the economic powerhouse that drives this state. What we cannot accept is that Delta farmers would be put out of business and our economy would be wiped out, the ecosystem would be wiped out, salmon fisheries would be wiped out, so that the Westlands farmers could continue to send almonds to China and to grow cotton in the desert.
Before we go too far into the intricacies of that particular debate, I want to ask Paul Rogers to come back into this and tell us, Paul, whether there is there any consensus on how much is too much, on how much water can be moved?
Not really. And what's interesting is that both Jason and Barbara were right in a lot of what they were saying. Westlands Water District has really done a lot in recent years in terms of water efficiency. They have huge amounts of drip irrigation, which, you know, depending on how you put it in, you can reduce water use by 40% when you put drip irrigation in. The problem is statewide that not all farmers have been that efficient, and we still have millions and millions of acres of land around the state that doesn't have those kind of modern technologies on it. We have canals around the state that aren't lined with clay where water seeps down into the ground. And basically, when you look at all the water in California that goes to human uses, quite often you hear people say the problem is that California's population is growing too fast. That's not the problem. 80% of all the water in California that goes to human uses is used by agriculture. That means all 38 million people and every business from Silicon Valley to Hollywood uses 20%. So when you talk about finding efficiencies, obviously you have to go to the place that's using the most water. I mean, the cities have done a lot, and farms have too, but farms going forward are going to have to do more.
And on the city question, there's an email from, or rather a comment on our website from someone in your fair city, Paul, from San Jose, who talks about how water rates have increased in San Jose, even though customers are using less. The water company needs to make a profit, so rates have gone up. And then this person sort of points the finger at Southern California and says, let the Los Angelinos conserve their water before we agree to sell them anymore. But, and this is the age-old debate, of course, but actually hasn't Southern California done pretty well in terms of water conservation?
Yes, they have. They've done very well. So has Northern California, as a matter of fact. I think most major cities in the North and the South are using about the same volume of water in terms of gallons right now as they were 20 years ago, even though the population has gone up. And there are a lot of programs in cities to, you know, replace shower heads, to replace toilets, and replace leaky water mains. The caller is right, or the emailer is right about prices. You seem to get it either way. When you have a drought and you use less, you think you should be rewarded, but that actually cuts the amount of revenue going in, so these areas raise their prices.
Back to our calls. John is next, calling from Vancouver, British Columbia this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. This question is for Carla, and I guess by extension generally. The other day, you were quoted as saying that the process is going to move along based on a slightly shift in philosophy, which calls for embracing scientific uncertainty. Now, I think that's a good idea, but I wonder, given yesterday's announcement, whether in fact that's going to happen. And also, what do you think that means in practice? Does it mean simply kicking the can down the road, or what? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, that's an important point that I think we need to put a closer lens on. And one of the fundamental challenges about the Delta as an ecosystem is how do we know what actions that we put forward in particular combinations, that's flows, that's habitat restoration to generate food sources, that's ways to deal with predator species, invasive species. How do we know that the combination of activities is going to produce the intended result? And I think we all acknowledge among the state and federal agencies that what we need to have in place in any kind of plan is a very strong science-based adaptive management program that can deal with these deal with the ecosystem more holistically. Currently, the way that we do that actually it's fractured within different agencies. Different agencies deal with different species, and sometimes they deal with them at cross purposes. So the plan that we're putting forward would, with you know these 200 plus biological goals and objectives, essentially provide both a scientific foundation and a scientific roadmap for how do we test the effectiveness of the actions that we're taking? How do we adaptively manage? How do we take in new science and have it guide our resource management decision making? So one of the things that we are focused on is particularly as it relates to operations of any new facility is embarking on an intensive joint science program over the next decade to test out several key scientific uncertainties that affect flows and the overall volumes of water moving through the system, both for environmental purposes and human uses.
But doesn't that Carla Nema, still leave you somewhat in the position of saying we're going to build it and we're going to figure out the science later?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There is, over the course of the last several years, the National Academies, Public Policy Institute of California, many other scientific bodies have all pointed in the direction of we need to separate water supplies from the estuary and do conduct a suite of measures that includes reoperating the system to deal with flows for fisheries, that includes the habitat restoration, that includes ways to address some of the other ecological stressors, that is the scientific path forward. I think the challenge is going to be, and this is where I think we very much need to think about things differently. We need all of our stakeholders to be open to the possibility of participating in an ongoing implementation process where we have a lot more public access to science. That's incredibly important for folks living in the Delta. It's important for environmental groups. It's important for water users.
Right, but this gets us right back to the question of trust, does it not, Barbara Berrigan-Perea? I mean, that you don't really count on the fact that, well, that there will be that sort of ongoing dialogue as science evolves.
Well, first off, Delta people, Delta counties have not been included in the BDCP process. We have not been the main player sitting at the table. But putting that aside, you know, the BDCP process...
Explain the acronym, if you would, please.
Bay Delta Conservation Plan process just about collapsed a couple months ago because in their own effects analysis, it was established that the science up to this point to support the project, that recovery of fish species very likely would not happen. And, you know, as recently as a month ago, the head of Fish and Game, Chuck Bottom, admitted that they don't understand the nexus between food production and habitat in the Delta. This policy put forth where you're going to build a project and then figure out 15 years of science, take 15 years to figure out the science and how to operate it, really puts plumbing before policy. And, you know, it puts plumbing before policy, and it will leave the Delta in a very, very bad situation.
Paul Rogers, weigh in on we've heard that phrase a lot in the last 24 hours, plumbing before policy.
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions. There's no question about that. And I think one of the basic questions is how much water will be run through the project and at what time of year. A second big question is we know that the big water districts, the farm water districts in the cities, are going to pay the $14 billion to build it. But then who pays the $10 billion in additional cost to operate it and to do all of this restoration of habitat that I mentioned? Finally, there hasn't been a cost-benefit analysis done yet. There was a bill in Sacramento earlier this year to do that, and it was defeated by many of the same large water agencies that are now supporting the project. The folks who are at Department of Water Resources who are shepherding this say those are all good questions, and they will come out during the EIR in the fall and during other documents. So that'll be something that a lot of folks are going to be looking at because, as I said at the beginning, this is far from a done deal, despite all the political muscle. It could easily end up on the ballot. Last time it ended up on the ballot, it was overwhelmingly defeated by Northern California counties. There are environmental groups who are going to sue no matter what on the environmental document, saying that it's not accurate. And then finally, the water agencies and the farmers might pull out if they aren't guaranteed the level of water that they want to get from this.
Let's get in one more caller, Gary in Calistoga. Gary, go ahead.
Hi. This is Gary Bobker. I'm the program director at the Bay Institute. Hi, everybody. Paul Rogers, who is one of the most accurate journalists I know, made a statement that I want to correct slightly. He talked about, in answer to a question from you, the split in the environmental community between groups like Restore the Delta that say, that there's just no justification under any means for a for a new facility, and other groups that are open to it. And it's true that there are groups like the Bay Institute and the Nature Conservancy and others who are open to the idea of a facility. But the split is not between those groups who say instead we should reduce exports and those other groups who say a facility is okay if we have 100,000 acres of habitat. One of the things that the environmental community is absolutely united on is that the current level of exports from the Delta is unsustainable, and that any new future for California water, whether it involves the current facilities, whether it involves building new facilities, has got to be sustainable, and that means that we have to reduce our exports significantly. There's absolutely no split there.
Gary, thanks. Thanks for adding that in. Just have a moment or two left, so I want to get the two sides on this one more chance to sort of weigh in on really what's at stake. Jason Peltier.
Well, what's at stake is the future of our state and whether we can make, in a lot of senses, and whether we can make a decision of this magnitude is the challenge to the people we've elected and the people they've appointed, and whether they can get their focus on their statutory responsibilities. The plumbing before policy notion is a bumper sticker, because we do have policy in California. The state legislature just a couple years ago established the co-equal goals of water supply and reliability along with ecosystem improvement. So we've got the policy in place, and now we need to get the facilities that will allow us and make the investment in the ecosystem that will allow us to achieve them.
And Barbara Berrigan-Perea, a brief last word.
Every day, water quality standards and salinity standards are violated in the Delta because of lack of enforcement from state and federal agencies. You don't build a house without a blueprint or a budget, and this project has neither.
Barbara Berrigan-Perea, she is the executive director of Restore the Delta. She joined us along with Jason Peltier, chief deputy general manager for the Westlands Water District. Carla Nemeth was here as well with the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Good luck, Carla. You have a big job ahead of you. And Paul Rogers, environmental reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Thanks for keeping us straight on all the facts, Paul.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Vinnie Tong. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson in for Michael Krasny today. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to talk about the problem of food allergies, some interesting new studies out that talk about the possibility of perhaps reversing food allergies among children. We'll get all into all of that in our second hour. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.